Empire presents Corwin. Tonight, in the sixth of his series of eight broadcasts for CBS, Norman Corwin brings you the distinguished actor of films and radio, Glenn Ford, in a repeat performance of Savage Encounter. The original musical score is by Harry Simeon and is conducted by Lud Bluskin. Glenn Ford in Norman Corwin, Savage Encounter.
Understand soon enough why I must omit certain details from the telling of this story. I was flying a seaplane in an area of the South Pacific en route to my base when I ran into a heavy electric storm. For upward of 3 hours, I flew blind, not knowing where I was and unable to see what lay below me. It was getting dark, and I had only about 20 minutes of fuel left when suddenly enough of the plane and lifted it with a cyclonic force 6 or 7,000 feet in a few seconds. And then, as though I were coming out of a dream, only to enter another, I was above the storm, and I saw rising before me a mountain peak, silhouetted against the pearly wash of a clearing sky lit by the full moon. There was nothing to do now but fly with the wind, negotiate the extremely narrow pass, and bail out on the other side. But once through the pass, I was dismayed to see dense forests on the other side. I jumped, having no other choice. Was so strong it carried my descent for miles. I finally hit the treetops with such force that I must have been knocked out. Because when I awoke, it was day. I was in a forest of vine-covered trees that rose straight for 100 feet. Interlocking at their tops to form a ceiling of leaves. There was a green glow all about. Gradually, I felt an instinctive alarm, and for good reason. There was something behind me. I got to my feet, but whatever it was that was standing in the brush, it didn't move. I took a step toward it. With a quick movement, the branches between its parted, and there came forward a native. He was about 7 feet tall, handsomely proportioned, his skin a coppery bronze in the shadows. I addressed him. Speaky English? He looked at me with fixed expression. I tried again. You know how speaking? You friend, white fella? He came closer, studied the wounds on my face for a moment, and then said an astonishing thing.
What dialect of a decent tongue are you mouthing?
You speak English? Oh, that's a break. I was afraid I might have come down in enemy territory. Oh, what island is this? Where's the base around here?
Base? Enemy territory? What does that mean?
Why, don't you know the enemy, the Japs?
You mean you don't? Has your wound disquitted you?
This what?
Whatever this cumbrance round your feet, cast it off and come with me.
Well, this is a parachute I bailed out in it last night. Saved my life.
I see.
What did you say the name of this island was?
Come with me. Come. Follow me.
He led me down to a stream along which we traveled for some time. During this, he said very little. Most of the way, he preceded me on the narrow trail, and so couldn't speak conveniently. But at one point, he stopped and turned to me with a wide grin.
Yes, we speak English.
Was I in a delirium? How else to explain the language of this native? His speech was certainly English, but it was a kind that I'd never heard before. Antique, archaic, stilted, strangely formed. We finally arrived at a place which, by my own promise and all I hold sacred, I cannot describe to you. It was a fair place, a beautiful place. That's almost the only way I can describe it. It was modest and livable. Above all, there was a dignity of life in that place that I'd never seen before. My rescuer and guide took me through curious and animated crowds to a place of assembly where a council was in session. They rose at my entrance, greeted me with silent nods, and listened to my friend's report. He delivered it with high humor, telling them how, while hunting, he had looked up and seen an odd object
descending in the sky. And I thought, what? A rickish pollen coming on the wind to breed with trees and make new combines of flora? For we see so much of jesting nature here. Fish flippant to the fin tip, and birds jocose from sunrim to night peep. I was prepared for some out-country creature conceived upon a mountain riverbed by low-lying vapors. And as he had not been discharged by any cloud that I could see above me, he couldn't have been a dewdrop.
I saw the laughter was not at my expense, for they seemed kindly disposed. And when my discoverer had finished, the leader of the council came over to where I was standing and took my hand.
We welcome you to these woods, to the fruit of our gardens and the produce of our hands. We invite you to take of us and be of us, to convive happily, both in our own name and in the name of Thomas, your brother, whose memory is quick and ageless among our nation.
I was too dazed at the moment to make any special note of his reference to Thomas, for immediately the others of the council approached and took my hand, and each greeted me. Something was said about my needing rest, and I was taken to a cottage overlooking the gardens of the... But I must be careful not to describe too much of this place. Again, for reasons you should... I was numb from my head wound and intoxicated by the brilliance of my surroundings. But once I had eaten, I yielded to fatigue and fell into a deep sleep. As though every level of my consciousness had been affected by this experience. Even my dreams were pleasant and full of exotic music. In the atmosphere, I awoke fresh and clear-headed, my injury well on its way to healing, and my spirits unaccountably light. And the events of that day served only to heighten this feeling. I was regarded by all with a sort of open affection that I always thought the province only of lifelong friends. Children flocked around me when I went about in the streets as though I were a favorite uncle. There was no superstition or mystic awe mixed up in it. The people of this place simply were happy to see me and didn't hesitate to show it. On the fifth evening, there was an occasion in my honor. Music and dancing, speaking of poetry. But even if that night had not been otherwise charged with sensation, I should remember it all my life for one thing. It was then and there that I met Ara, daughter of the leader of the council. Ara, of the blue-black hair and eyes that outshone the proudest constellation in the heavens. Ara, oh blessed name. It was Ara who told me about Thomas as we walked by the lakeshore afterward, hands clasped. How a man was cast up on the far shores of their island 3 centuries ago, the only survivor of a shipwreck.
Tall is he, your color, white hair. A legend writ of him in after years swore that a cloud stayed on his brow. A very human is a consideration.
How he had been a profound and good and forceful man. and the student of the great poets of his time.
Shakespeare, Marlowe, and Webster. He bore their sea-soaked pages of the Lib Art Fairy for Young. Purposely, tenderly, yet with a haughty and prideful eye.
How he had found her people so gifted of intellect, so benignly civil, so acquisitive of knowledge that he gave up all thought of returning to his own country. He lived among them, telling them little of the temporal matters of his own world, but teaching them all the best of its poetry. And so great was the native genius for the spoken word, so complete their fascination in it, that soon English came to be their second tongue.
And growing supple with usage, became at last our elective speech, for we pitched upon it.
This, then, explained the peculiar idiom spoken here.
Yes, quite as you say, a transplanted language, flourishing like some wind-blown and accidental seed dropped in foreign soil.
Apparently, Thomas was hitherto the only white man they'd ever seen, and I was, in effect, the first bulletin from the outside world in more than 300 years. Thus, I suppose it was natural that they should think me the same stripe as the sainted Thomas. For my part, I fully reciprocated the kind attitudes they displayed toward me. And as for my feelings for Ara... the night I dined, or convived, as they put it, at the place of Karam, Ara's father. I was talking with an elder named Shargo when, in the course of conversation, I began to expand on the subject of my adventures in the war. Quickly, the room fell silent. I attributed this to the interest they took in my story, and with growing eloquence... I admit I was somewhat animated by drink and perhaps more loquacious than usual. I recounted briefly the history of the outer world since the time of Thomas. Its wars, its industrialization, its panics, its depressions. I told them about the wonders of radio and the airplane, as well as the various uses to which they had been put. They listened without a word, at times looking at each other quizzically, but never interrupting. I told them of the First World War and of the intervening years, of the origins and career of World War II. At length, Tara made a little gesture as if to speak. I stopped.
You tell us, then, that 30 years ago your people slaughtered 20 millions of each other with cruel murdering pieces.
Why, yes, 1914 to 18.
And now today, simultaneously with our sitting here, your nations are killing once again.
Yes, I... We're already about 20 million killed in this one so far, and it's not over yet by any means.
And nothing learnt between. Nothing extraught from the many wars and bloody garboil?
Oh, sure, in a way. Sure, we've learned how to kill more efficiently. War is a full-blown science now.
Tell us more.
I went on, encouraged by the amazement and astonishment on the faces of my hosts. And when I had finished, I sat back, pleased with my account. For a moment, nobody spoke. Then Taram rose.
The night is old and the moon is set. We must part now. Our solemnly guest shall be escorted home. But I would have the council remain.
I thought it peculiar that the party, which began so informally, should end in this manner, and that I should be assigned an escort, when up to now it had been considered quite all right for me to go about alone. And I was still more puzzled when, as I was leaving and started to cross the room to say goodnight to Ara, I was intercepted by Shargo, ostensibly for the purpose of asking me a question. It was a small, pointless question, and I'm sure merely a ruse to delay me, for upon disengaging myself from Shargo, I noticed Ara was no longer in the room. The attitude of my host seemed to have changed. They were so courteous and kind that I found that fewer people spoke to me. And these less freely than before. I was detained close by my cottage on this excuse and that. Now, what concerned me even more was the fact that, though I'd been seeing Aura daily since we met, she was now mysteriously absent from her father's house. I made inquiries for her, and Taram explained.
Aura has gone to the lakes on errand.
Oh, when will she be back?
I cannot say.
I returned, sullen, to my cottage, and was shocked to find that on the pretext of needed repairs to its roof, I was being moved up to what they called the High Holt, a wooded section some distance from the gardens. The new place was even larger and more luxurious than the old one, but I was aware that the warm and open hospitality of the country had deteriorated to a sort of protective custody. I waited. For minutes, nothing stirred. Then something happened that made my blood freeze. No sooner had a cloud drifted across the moon and darkened the woods than a figure slipped through the curtains of the window, noiseless as a shadow, and was standing in the room above me. I rose to my elbow, my fingers tight around my knife. Who is it? Who is there?
It's I. Aura.
Oh, Aura, my love.
Oh,
Aura.
I'm forbode to see you. But I've stolen away here to tell you of the danger.
What danger?
They've marked you out as savage.
I, a savage?
Yes, but they say you come of ugsome people. And society is so wasted by greed and savage instinct.
But, Dara, how can they?
Quickly, I'll find out.
But why? What have I done?
They dread you will subvert our youth by story and example. And we are people of
what do they intend to do with me?
I fear they will kill you on an unsuspecting moment.
But I thought they liked me.
Oh, they look on you fondly. But they're fearful. Lest all innocent you plant the cancer of your dispiteous world among us.
But I wouldn't do that.
I must go below until they discover me.
Oh, but Aura, you're not safe. Why did you come?
Because I love you. And for law.
Oh, Aura, my
I'm
darling.
I'm spiritless and all immortal without you.
There, standing in the doorway, were two giant native guards. Silently, they came to Aura. One gently took her arm, and she went out between them, speaking not a word. They said nothing to me beyond apologizing for the disturbance.
We regret to have intruded on your privacy. Good night, sir, and deep sleep to you.
My food to be poisoned, and so I didn't eat. I expected to be killed in my sleep, so I didn't sleep.
Shall the bed be ready?
No, I'm not tired.
You have not rested since noon's bed 2 days.
I tell you, I'm not tired. I'll let you know when I am.
We await your pleasure.
I expected them to pounce on me when I walked about in the holt, but nobody came near. Finally, I could stand it no longer. Guard!
You called, sir.
Look, see here. I've had enough of this. I demand to see Taram immediately, do you understand?
He shall be told.
I was sure this would do me no good, but to my great surprise, later that same day, Taram arrived at the Holt. He was downcast and seemed much older than when I saw him last, as though he had been through a terrible ordeal. He bore bad news. Aura was being held for treason, and the council had decided that I must die. I asked them what they would do to Aura.
She, too, is under sentence.
You have made up your minds.
All but to hear you.
Hear me?
Our code is to inform the accused one of our charges, and to hear him out.
Oh, what good will that do?
Little. Less than little. Not unless you're persuasive against the damning testaments of your own lips.
You're putting me on trial, is that it?
Yes. We are putting you on trial.
Ancient hospitalities, do what we must. For then and only then, good judges, can we be proof against unimaginable woes. This war, by his report, engulfed all of the oceans of the world, save for this haply mirage-hidden island. How long, if he escape and does rejoin his usual barbaric company, should we stay unconsidered in their strategies?
But you have my word, I tell them nothing about you.
His word? Respected judges, he himself has told us of the history of treaties in his forlorn society.
You're deliberately misinterpreting what I said the other night.
Oh, this prosecution is small pleasure to us all. Consider him. In face, resembling Thomas. In language, uncouth but understandable. A brave and hardy fellow. Outwardly, a worthy and a gracious man. Yet, inward, what decay sits still and waits? How else than by a vile inheritance of blood could lusts and fratricidal passions so control the children of the fighters of the wars that they, the children, persist in making up and fighting new wars of their own? Is there no love among their schemes? Good judges, these are the risks of an acquittal. First, that he escapes. Next, that staying in our midst alive, he, by ingratiation and insisture, by devices uncanny, such as that which he calls radio, by the same perversions of wit and skill that have rendered this race of savages sovereign over the bird, will subtly and wickedly corrupt our people. Already he but touches a maiden, the noble daughter of our noblest leader, and she so deep contracts the special sickness of this savage that she hurries through the night to betray her people by forewarning him. We, all of us, agree and are together saddened that this very personable and by certain lights this innocent young man should, for the sake of the tranquility and peace of generations yet unnumbered on this island, be forfeit of his years and die under the sentence of this council. Yet these are good causes that I account here, the highest of all. And he, alas for him, is overmatched by them. For in his world, by all that he has freely told us, there is such bale, such epidemic misery, hunger amid great riches, and the lessons of catastrophe continuing unlearned, we cannot but assume some awful growth is rampant in their blood, breeding in cycles, and affecting finally the very seat of reason. Our guest, so logic and quiescent now, like Thomas of that old and better world, may be the carrier of a black plague striking the inner organs of the soul. We cannot risk this prospect in our nation. I call upon you to pronounce the edict of his execution in the name of the various peoples by whom you have been here deputed.
These are the weights against you, good friend, our guest. We shall listen if you wish to speak.
I certainly do wish to speak. First of all, get rid of any idea that I'd willingly stay here if you were to reprieve me on condition that I don't try to escape, because I would try. I would try to escape to the very war which you've condemned and by whose conduct you consider me a savage.
Why? Why?
I don't know what else.
Because I have a share of fighting yet to do in that war. And not even for this sublime island and all the dignity and sweetness of your life here would I remain while other men are dying for a cause that I consider just as sacred as you do your own. Listen. Any fool could understand your caution to keep this thing you have. But let me ask you something. Was it always this way here? Did you come out of the earth complete with laws and culture? Oh, it doesn't matter whether you came up from a tadpole or an ape. Somewhere along the line, you had to fight. You had to conquer beasts or else be conquered. Well, that's the way it is with us today. We're fighting beasts. Animals far wilder than anything you've ever had to face. We're fighting the makers of wars. And that's not easy for people who, like you, are brought up to prefer peace. You make the mistake of lumping together as savages the makers of war and the breakers of war. Oh, there's a difference between the two. And men are willing to die for that difference. We call them men of goodwill. And there are millions of them fighting for just such a kind of life as you've got here. How do you mean to say that you deny to others the blessings you have found? Can it mean that you're willing to take, but not give? You took what Thomas had to offer, and you found it good enough to make a saint of him. Well, I can tell you that there are many Thomases, present and future, who can bring you countless good and wonderful things, and will, after we've finished with the fascists. Before this war, all of our countries were islands, like yourself. Each one of us cut off in spirit from the rest of the world, as you are cut off in fact. But now we're together, and the leaders are meeting. And one nation gives to the other what it needs, as you people do here among yourselves. Well, that's where we stand. As for you, you can sit alone if you choose and hoard your riches like a miser counting gold, or else you can help those who are poor in wisdom to reach what seems to you so obvious and easy, simply because you reached it so long ago. In a very small way, you can start helping by letting me go back to the fight. But whatever you decide to do to me, what about Ara? She's accused of treason. Why? Because she ran through the woods to warn the man she loved? That's not treason. Treason is deliberate and studied. Not a girl's panic for the safety of her lover in the night. Is there no love among your schemes? I say to you, release us. Let her go. Let me go. And I will make a vow to tell nobody where to look for you. At least, not until our civilization is worthy of your acquaintance.
Goodbye, my old Alyssa. Go safely. And my love be constant with you.
Goodbye, beloved. Beloved Ara.
May you find the way to your people. And may your people find their way to peace.
I'll try to come back, Ara. And if I can't, my world will come to you. And it will be a part of me as I am a part of it.
I shall dream forever of the all of you.
Once more I fill my eyes with your face. And then I go. All right, friend. The blindfold. Here. Does it bind too close? No, no. That's comfortable. So, take my hand. And so, blindfolded, I was led up the slopes and through the pass. It was an extra precaution on the part of my hosts, but quite unnecessary. One day, when all the savagery of inhumanity to man is rooted out, when all the many inequalities are evened up all over the whole of our known world, when we have won, I shall borrow a plane. I shall head
for a certain quadrant of a certain ocean. And then I shall look for a storm to get lost in.
Listening to Glenn Ford as the pilot in Savage Encounter, a fantasy for radio, written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin, as the sixth in a special series of broadcasts under the familiar title, Columbia Presents Corwin. Harry Simeon composed the musical score, which was conducted by Lud Gluskin. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.